Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James.
Hey, g'day everyone.
It is the 2nd of February, and this is episode 45. Big show for you guys coming up. We are going to be talking to Gideon Rosner about the new donations changes to, the new changes to donations law.
Yes.
And the concept of a living wage, which Shorten's been big on this week. We're also going to be talking to Deb Sims about Ron Walker and the right to try legislation that he was championing, mm-hmm. and also what the IPA's got planned for a bit of 75th anniversary.
So yeah, okay.
We've actually got a scoop.
Big party.
Actually got a scoop. This is quite big.
Oh, yeah, the scoop. Yep, sorry.
Cool. So we'll get into some stories that have happened around the world this week. So we'll start off with the donations changes. So obviously this is something that's been capturing the Australian imagination a lot this week.
Yes.
Now, started a few months ago. We were talking to Chris Berg about it last year. So obviously Sam Dastyari got in a fair bit of hot water for taking money from people connected to the Chinese government.
From the communists.
Mm. And he's now had to resign from the Senate. So there was a lot of changes, like the government going, well, how do we stop this happening again? So it's going to be a lot of restrictions on what kind of donations could be made to Australian political figures from foreign powers. Now, the thing that's come out this week is the actual wording of the bill as it was introduced sort of will start to affect charity groups or anyone with sort of like a public voice.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a... if you've got a charity or an organisation that comments on an issue that could potentially swing electors, which is, you know...
everyone.
Every issue and every person, because every person votes for something, you're going to be affected by these changes. So we're going to be talking to Gideon Rosner about that coming up later in the show.
Yes.
What you can do if you're really interested is we've got a submission on our website about what our problems are with the bill as it is introduced. And if you do want to know a bit more about what the problems are with limiting foreign donations and the restrictions on free speech that it is, make sure you go back last year when we talked to Chris Berg about it.
Jump on the webby.
Yeah, absolutely. So Pete, let's talk Peter Ritt.
Okay, yep, jump into Peter Ritt. So you might have seen, hey, what did I miss yesterday? Professor Peter Ritt from James Cook University is suing his university because they put a censure and gag motion on him. And apparently trawled through his private emails as a result of an interview he gave with Alan Jones in August last year about the chapter he wrote for the IPA's book, Climate Change the Facts, 2017. So he's a reef scientist, a Great Barrier Reef scientist, and he criticised the quality of science, basically, with regards to the Great Barrier Reef, and I'm no expert with that, so I'm not going to go into that, but he criticised the way that they conduct their research, and as a result of that, he copped this censure from his university. Clearly, this is an encroachment upon academic freedom in Australia, and it's a huge issue because the science that he and his colleagues do decides how billions of dollars get spent.
Yeah.
So he's challenging his university in the federal court. What he has done is sought to raise money to fund that legal challenge. He's putting up $24,000 himself, but he's also seeking to raise some money because he can't afford to do all of it. We put that in Hey What Did I Miss yesterday, overnight, thousands and thousands of dollars have been raised. So
yeah.
It's been fantastic. But if you do want to get the link for that, jump on the website.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you'll see it.
Yeah, so the IPA put out a media release yesterday with a few quotes from John Roskam talking about, can't believe this is happening. Obviously, it's a university. Don't we want people trying to get to the truth, even at the cost of other people's feelings?
Yeah, yeah.
And there is a link to that GoFundMe. Peter Ritt also made a video about it.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a talking about what's going on. We shared that on Facebook yesterday. So if you go to our Facebook page, just scroll through a few of the last links, you'll stumble on that video pretty quickly.
It's really resonated with people. I've received a lot of emails already from Hey yesterday talking about, you know, I've donated, this is really important. John made an important point that this is not a new thing. This is not like the first time something like this has happened. He referred back to the Bjorn Lomborg thing when, you know...
Which was crazy.
Oh, it's like, this guy doesn't believe... It's not even that he didn't... Anyway, I don't want to rehash this whole thing, but it's not even that he didn't agree. He disagreed with them. It's that he didn't agree that climate change was... He thought climate change was happening, but he didn't think it was as big a problem as other problems.
Yeah, yeah.
He
didn't agree with them enough.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly.
It's either total blind agreement or get out of there.
Anyway, that's on the website too.
Yeah, so go check on that. Really important issue. So another thing that's come up this week. So this is from the ABC. Federal Labor will establish...
Oh, sorry.
No, it's actually... We'll get into that
later.
Yeah. This was publicly released. It wasn't found in someone's cabinet.
Yeah.
So Federal Labor will establish a commission to look into possible and systemic corruption in the federal government and public service if it wins the next election.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we're going to have like a just this big old federal inquiry into corruption.
Yeah.
probably won't do anything. And the problem is so we put out a media release. You go, Pete.
Oh, well, yeah. Just so we are obviously, as an organisation, anti-corruption.
Yeah, I would say this is a podcast, anti-corruption podcast.
We're not pro-corruption.
No.
But...
moral corruption?
Oh,
a dabble.
In the eye. Wow. Yeah. So are you going to talk now?
Yes. So we got a media release that we put out. Simon Breeny. So introducing a new... I'll quote from the media release. Yeah. Introducing New South Wales style... ICAC-style kangaroo court into the federal sphere is a good idea if you believe in trampling on fundamental legal rights. Corruption commissions are notorious.
Saki.
Yeah, sarcasm. If corruption commissions are notorious for abrogating the right to silence, reversing the presumption of innocence, and spurring rules of evidence. A federal corruption commission would exacerbate the existing legal rights crisis in Australia. I mean, last year, and you can talk. We talked to Morgan about this in January, I think. There are 324 legal rights provisions. Legal rights breaching provisions in current Commonwealth legislation. And now we're going to have a corruption commission, which is going to even worsen that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not the greatest day for Australian legal rights.
No, and as he points out for later on in that release, it just turns into a political tool to get your opponents. Mm. Anyway.
Absolutely. So we'll also talk... I'll go again. Human Freedom Index came out. So this is a huge thing that Cato do also with the Fraser Institute in Canada, Cato in America, and the Liberales Institute at Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom in Germany.
It's awesome index.
Yeah, so it's basically measuring every country in the world by how free they are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can exacerbate a lot of things. Australia came in fifth.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty good. Good enough, but pretty good.
I've got a theory about this, James.
Okay, go ahead.
So, as you're about to probably say, we became high in New Zealand.
Yes. New Zealand were third?
Yeah. So, if we're fifth in the world, which you think that's pretty good out of all the countries in the world, we were fifth last year, so we sort of remained steady. But if we were the fifth test-playing nation in the world, and we were behind New Zealand...
But if there are 192 test-playing
nations... There'd be a national outrage. We are... I don't think... We might be... I'm not even sure where we are. Let me Google that. You keep going on to Google that.
Well, Peter was looking up sport. Cato released all the figures, how they came to these conclusions. It's not exactly, you know, a bunch of people in a boardroom going like, "Hey, you feel fifth? I feel fifth." So there's a different algorithm that they have. So what's holding Australia back? What's holding us beneath New Zealand? Yeah, we've got really low rankings in government consumption and top marginal tax rate. And it's like, if only there was an organisation consistently arguing for less government consumption and a lower marginal tax rate.
Yeah.
People should join the IPA, is exactly what I'm saying. Right. We'll get into that a bit later. But Pete, where is Australia in these cricket rankings?
Well, I can't find it. It's coming up with just the batting. Hang on. Test nation.
All right, I will keep talking.
You guys talk amongst yourselves.
Yep. Okay. This is fantastic radio.
Oh, no, I've got it. Why would it?
Brilliant radio. I'm going to move on. We'll save the best to last. This story was hilarious.
Third and in front of New Zealand.
No one cares.
Nobody cares.
This was the greatest story that I've seen coming out of Australia for a while. It's one of those ones. I texted a friend of mine, who works like near the show Utopia, if this was a script that they put forward for Utopia, it would be knocked back for ridiculousness.
Yeah.
Like, how is this possible? Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's department has launched an, quote, urgent investigation into how two filing cabinets containing classified and sensitive government documents were mistakenly sold at a second-hand furniture shop in Canberra.
They got their best man on it.
That is a sentence.
I'm going to demand an investigation from the same people that lost the bloody thing.
Urgent investigation.
Yeah. Crikey.
The real headline would be we're not doing a whole lot about it, just chalk it up to experience and move on.
Yeah.
So, in extraordinary lapse of security, the documents, which include federal cabinet papers that should have not been made public for at least 20 years, were apparently bought by a member of the public and eventually passed on to the ABC.
Yeah.
First off, that member of the public, what, you don't listen to the world's greatest podcast?
Yeah, exactly. Give it to us. We're not going to read through all those papers, though. We don't have to get the interns
through. Secret government papers. I'm having a quick squeeze.
But so much of it would be boring. Yeah. But the thing about that was, so he did it.
Very few of them were boring, by the way.
This guy who bought the filing cabinets is just as bad as everyone else because he bought the filing cabinets, ones that he knew that he couldn't open, and it said he had them for 6 months before he opened them with a drill. So he's like, these are just sitting in his backyard, and his missus is like, when are you going to open those filing cabinets? I told you we didn't need them. So I blame him too.
Yeah, it's probably some hipster who's just like, oh, this would look really good in the decor
of the
house.
Not being able to open them is cool.
Yeah, exactly. And then I'm going to have some artisanal coffee. So here are some of the documents that we've found. So it's stuff about like how the Australian Federal Police lost hundreds of national security files, which I plan on bringing up next time they ask for more power.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, these are the people.
Guys, your data is safe with us. Yeah. Your data is safe with us.
End up in a bloody filing cabinet.
Has anyone seen that file on the terrorism suspect? Yep. I cannot find it. I swear I put it down on that table. Yep. It's not there anymore.
Who's got the keys to this filing cabinet?
What else we got here? How desperate Labor were for Telstra to buy the NBN.
Is that right?
Yeah. They were like, oh boy, we're in this deep.
This is an absolute lemon.
There's concerning ones like Howard tried to remove the rights of silence for terrorism suspects, which is a bit rough. And also that Rudd was warned about the critical risk of pink bats.
Interesting.
So he's actually now suing the ABC for reporting that because, you know, it's been, I don't know what his angle is, but that is very damaging. All right, cool. That is what we've got as stories for this week. We're now going to go to our interviews with Gideon Rosner. We're going to be talking a whole lot more about the donation stuff from before and Deborah Sims. But before we go, we should probably talk membership. Now, Nina, as I said before, we need an organization that's going to be standing up for freedom. We need to beat New Zealand.
That's
right.
It
should be a national crisis.
That's right.
What is an organization that the people would join?
It's the Institute of Public Affairs, people.
Nina's director of the New Zealand
Initiative.
No.
Well, we've actually had them on.
Yeah, we've had them on.
Got to stop giving them airtime.
Yeah. Sorry, go on, Nina.
So, yeah, if you believe that we need this organization, join us. Just go to ipa.org.au and click on the join button. And as low as $22 for a year, you can be a member of IPA and you'll receive 4 editions of IPA Review every year and also weekly emails of, hey, what did I miss from James Hall, Pete Gregory and Morgan Hag.
Who's in charge of the filing cabinets at the IPA? Is that Poon? Or?
That's me. Oh, okay. Oh, my God. I shouldn't say anything.
Yes. Now, Nina, do not sell them to a furniture store.
I was about to.
Did you nearly swear?
Yeah.
For the first time in Nina's life, she nearly swore.
This is a family podcast.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So we'll go to our interviews now. Okay, we are now joined by IPA Research Fellow Gideon Rosner. Gideon, welcome back to the show.
G'day, great to be here.
Cool. Freshly back from his safari in Southern Africa.
Among other things.
And he's come back with a fire in his belly because it's been a huge week for you. Yes. Talking about the donations law that's just come out and, some more details have just come out of and Bill Shorten's stance on the living wage. So we'll get to the living wage second, but I do want to talk about the bill. So obviously this bill has been in the works for a few months now, really. Came out after the Sam Dastyari scandal became public, and we always thought it was going to be mainly affecting foreign donations to political parties. But there's stuff that's coming out this week that says that's not exactly true. Do you want to tell us what's happened?
Well, that's right. And I've come back at sort of an interesting time because this particular bill has really been grinding my gears.
It couldn't rest on Safari.
No, and I'm ready to break some conditioning over this bill.
Here he goes.
So the bill was introduced ostensibly to tackle foreign donations and to ban foreign donations. Mm-hmm. And under the as a result or because of the Sam Dastyari affair and concern over so-called foreign influence in our political system. But the coalition has also attached to the bill measures that would extend the funding and disclosure requirements of the Australian Commonwealth Electoral Act to what they refer to as non-party actors, organisations that, you know, we've seen them campaigning at polling booths. Anybody who's been there, they hand out independent scorecards and so on. Organisations, you know, we all know what they are, but they don't run candidates
themselves.
They get
up and do a lot of things.
They get up and say things and, you know, whoever they are. So the bill is purportedly aimed at so-called levelling the playing field between political parties and these groups. Now, I don't like extending electoral law anyway. I think that there's always a risk that you verge into murky waters when you're trying to manage the debate and manage how people participate in the democratic process. But the problem with this bill is the way that it is drafted, it will go way beyond even what it aims to do. And the reason for that is it requires entities to register with the Australian Electoral Commission if they spend a certain amount of money per year on political purposes. And political purposes are included the following definition: the public expression by any means of views on an issue that is or is likely to be before electors at an election. Now, voters vote for all sorts of reasons. So every issue is before every voter at every election.
Yeah.
So what this will result in is potentially any organisation that makes a comment on any public policy issue whatsoever having to register with the Australian Electoral Commission. St Vincent de Paul's may have to register because they talk about homelessness. Mm-hmm. An Indigenous corporation organisation may have to register because they talk about the state of remote communities. A sporting club may have to register if they spend a certain amount of money talking about the adequacy of parks and leisure facilities. So this has huge reach, huge implications for civil society, an enormous compliance burden, and sets an extremely bad precedent because for the first time, laws that are aimed at political parties are being applied to organisations that merely comment on public policy matters. It's very, very concerning.
So in Hey, What Did I Miss yesterday, we wrote that this was as big an impingement on freedom of speech as Section 18C. Can you talk us through how this is an impingement on freedom of speech?
Well, a few reasons. Firstly, we'll have inevitably a chilling effect on speech. Charities that have to do all sorts of things contained in this bill, like, for example, register with the AEC and file an annual return, appoint a financial controller, and, by the way, can go to jail potentially if they don't comply sufficiently with these laws because breaching them is a criminal offence, will shrug their shoulders and not bother. This is an affront to freedom of speech, A, because of the chilling effect it will have on organisations that participate in public debate, but also the precedent it sets to regulate anybody having a say on any issue by a government commission. This is like 18C on steroids.
Mm. The other part of it is, and you talk about the chilling effect, if, you know, I don't want to shock you guys here, but the AEC don't have the tightest of security. So, you know, some people's details about what they donated and where they donated it to are probably going to come out. And you look at what's happening in America this morning where the guy that runs Coachella, if you guys don't know, it's a huge music festival in America. He donates to some pretty hardcore right-leaning Christian groups. Now that's public. And I'm sure this guy doesn't exactly want
that is
public.
So surprising.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a good way to make money is to run a music festival and invite a bunch of LA hipsters to it. But the point is, like, this is going to discourage people donating money to causes that they really feel passionate about because they are worried it's going to affect their professional career. Because there's a massive hashtag right now, like, boycott Coachella, just because this guy donates a little bit of money on the side to these groups.
Well, that is exactly what the bill is, in fact, intended to do, is to require organisations to disclose details about their donors. And you're absolutely right. You know, we have freedom of speech in this country. Speech is more than just the ability to speak about, to literally speak. It's also to support, financially or otherwise, organisations that promote and espouse your values. And part and parcel of that is the right to privacy. We have the secret ballot in this country. We were the first to ever have a secret ballot because if you don't have a secret ballot, people can potentially be intimidated or retributed against based on how they vote. The same principle applies to donations. The poor bloke who runs Coachella and privately, as a private citizen, believes in certain causes, is now having his music festival boycotted. And he may be spit on if he attends his own music event.
Mm.
That is the incursion into freedom of speech and the chilling effect that we're talking about here.
Mm. So what are your recommendations, Gideon, for this bill?
I would like to see the bill scrapped outright, but failing that, the extension of it to civic groups needs to be dramatically, dramatically redrafted because as it's currently drafted, the legal effect of it will have consequences that the government doesn't even intend. Really, this is aimed at groups that act like political parties but aren't, but don't run candidates. But the effect and the implications for the wider civil society are very, very scary and very concerning.
Yeah, and the other part of, like, we talk about the free speech effect. I also want to talk about the red tape effect of it because that's another thing that's really prevalent here, which is it is hard enough to run a charity for these places. It's hard enough to run, you know, places that are going to be affected like this, like you say, like, you know, Rotary could get affected or, like, organisations like that. And now we've got to probably hire a new guy just to make sure they're compiling with the AEC. Maybe it's two people. Maybe it's, we all have to spend a few hours of the week compiling with the AEC. So less money is actually going towards the outcomes of these causes. I mean, everyone gets on case like, you know, oh, does this charity actually help homelessness? Does this charity actually help Indigenous people? Well, less now, and it's because of the government. Because there is money that's going to be just funneled through to filing paperwork.
Well, that's exactly the point. And the other thing that's being raised in this debate by the charitable sector and by charity organisations that there already is a hefty regime in place federally to regulate charities.
There is. Yeah.
So a lot of those obligations, those same obligations, are about to be duplicated. And charities are throwing up their hands. I was tuning into the committee coverage yesterday and saying, look, we're drowning in red tape as it is. You want to duplicate it, make it even worse, and potentially send us to jail for not complying?
Yeah.
Enough. We know we're just trying to help people. And occasionally, we might advocate on the causes we believe in. But fundamentally, leave us alone. Enough is enough. And, exactly. And I don't particularly blame them for making that point.
Absolutely. Let's move on to another topic. So another thing that's come out this week, Bill Shorten this week talked to the press club, I think it was, and he talked about a lot how Labor's going to make a living wage a big part of their platform this year. Do you want to tell us what a living wage is and how it's different to a minimum wage?
Well, it's a completely different concept than a minimum wage. It's, for too long we've had a dying wage in this country, so finally we're going to get a living wage.
So sick of that damn dying wage.
That dying wage, it's a bugbear of mine. No, look, and I feel a bit like Groundhog Day, because I remember, I think on this very podcast, we were talking about this when the ACTU ran with it. Basically,
this is fresh and original every time.
Fresh and original. Basically, what we're talking about is a marketing exercise. This is a cute motherhood statement that really means a massive hike in the minimum wage. The minimum wage is currently set by the Fair Work Commission. The system isn't perfect. And minimum wage is one of the highest in the developed world, as it is. What the unions and the Labor Party want to do is to take away the independent process of the Fair Work Commission and have an automatic arbitrary measure where the minimum wage is at least 60% of the average wage, the median wages in this country. So it'll mean a one-off hit to minimum wages. It will mean that the minimum wage is higher. Now, that's fantastic if you already have a job. But for the 700,000 people in this country who are looking for work, who are unemployed, that will mean that they will miss out.
Yeah, they'll get even harder to be employed right now.
Even harder than it is now. And we know that there are a lot of businesses that would love a bit of extra help. There are people who would love to offer their labour at below the minimum wage, whether it's because they don't have experience or they've got a criminal record and they otherwise won't get a look in, or for whatever other reason. But as a matter of law, it will be unlawful for them to reach a mutually beneficial agreement with their would-be boss to offer their services, and that's sick.
So this notion, just going back to the notion of the living wage, minimum wage is, of course, already a living wage. Like, it's formulated on the notion of being a living wage.
At its inception, the Harvester Judgment back in the 1900s was invented. The minimum wage was created on the basis that, you know, every Australian deserves a living wage and there's a certain minimum. So in theory, it's a living wage anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's the minimum wage has outgrown its usefulness as a political slogan, and now we're talking about a living wage. Yeah. And Bill Shorten's brought the agenda, and we'll hear about it for the next 18 months.
Exactly. And so this was something that Pete had in Hey Today. What people think is like a dying wage, or like an unliving wage, is a lot higher than what most other countries think a living wage is, because Australia actually has one of the highest minimum wages among any OECD country. So that's even crazier that we're thinking of raising it because of the terrible cost it's going to have when so many countries are already a bit lower.
So we're third in the world, just after Luxembourg and the Netherlands, but higher than any other economy. But also the other point to make is, and this is what our colleague Matthew Lesh raised with me today, and it's absolutely correct. After tax and transfers, after welfare payments, you actually end up, minimum wage earners actually end up receiving on a net basis 60-odd percent of the median wage anyway.
Depending on their status, if they're single or...
Oh, if you're single, you're out of luck because you don't have kids, you don't have all sorts of benefits. But if you're married or have children, you basically end up with 60% of median earnings anyway.
Which is what the unions are asking for in the union wage, or the living wage.
They're asking for it in 60%. Gross terms. Yeah. So, we already in effect have what they're asking for, but, it's out there now. That's the journey's out of the bottle. And again, the unions are very, very good at dressing up terrible ideas in great slogans. And here's another one.
All right, cool. So if you guys listening want to read more about what Gideon's been saying, obviously the media release that we've put out about the living wage stuff up on our website, as is Gideon's submission based on what he thinks about, or what the IPA thinks about, the changes to the donation laws. But Gideon, as Pete said at the start, you just got back from safari. We've got a few minutes left here. What is a country that you recommend our listeners get out and see?
I would definitely recommend Zanzibar. It's a semi-autonomous island state off the coast of Tanzania. Fantastic place. It's got sort of like the New Orleans of Africa. It's in different times. Well, in terms of the cultural intersection, it's got a bit of Portuguese, it's got a bit of Persian, a bit of Arabic, bit of, you know, obviously indigenous African. Great seafood, great beaches.
Cheap beers.
Pizza.
That's correct. Go by pizza ranks.
I wouldn't know too much about
alcohol. Why are you talking about the seafood, mate?
Sorry?
Why are you talking about the seafood? No, carry on.
I go for the natural beauty and the seafood. You leave the beers to you. But it's a really, really cool country. But the whole continent's fantastic.
Now, some people collect stamps. You collect being able to say cheers in a number of different languages.
That's correct.
Why don't you give us the new ones that you picked up? Because there's one in particular.
It's not that you just look it up on, like, Duolingo.
It's
lived experience. That's an important thing for me.
That's true, yeah.
That's correct. So,
because there was one in particular which I was very impressed with.
Well, in Swahili, in Zanzibar, it's Maisha Maref.
Very good.
But in Zulu in South Africa, I learned that the word for cheers is Ingaba.
Can I get that again, please?
In Naba.
That's absolutely so
cool.
Sensational.
Yeah, how cool is that?
Yeah, yeah.
I want to be able to say that one day. Yeah. Friday night drinks, that's what I'm going with.
Yeah.
Right.
But we'll learn how to say it off the mic.
Yeah, yeah.
That's full of danger. But Gideon, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here.
Okay, we now welcome back to the show the Director of Relationships and Engagement here at the IPA, Deb Sims. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Now, very cool. So, Deb, big week for you, actually. Victorians would know there was a lot of coverage about it. So Ron Walker, someone very involved with things such as the Grand Prix and a lot of philanthropic work, passed away this week. And Ron Walker was someone that meant a whole lot to you. Do you want to talk about why?
Yeah, I really don't think I would have been here had it not been for Ron going very public with his cancer journey, and the fact that he took his life into his own hands and tried to find a cure for his cancer when he was told he only had months to live in 2012. So sadly, he died this week, but he had 5 years of extra life because he travelled around the world to find a drug which worked for him for a significant period of time. And he came back and campaigned to get that drug made available to other people. So 180,000 patients are on that drug now in Australia. And I read his story at the point that I was told I had a few months to live. And I thought, well, I don't have the millions that Ron has, but my children deserve.
Yeah.
Yeah. One day, you know, on an IPA salary, I'll get there. my children deserve me to do everything I can to try and save my life and find a drug. And I went to America and I found the drug and ended up on a clinical trial. And so by going public, he really did, it was a game changer for people like me because it made us realise that we could do the same thing. And now my quest is to find out how we can make sure that people, no matter how much money they have, can access these drugs. And that's why I'm going down the line of right to try, because that is a way that patients can take responsibility for their own healthcare and access these drugs outside clinical trials and hopefully, you know, get a chance to have a second life.
We go down the right to try rabbit hole with you before. It's just so damn interesting. I mean, obviously, like, risk of being Victorian-focused again, but Victoria's really right now talking a lot about safe injecting rooms, so like whether or not people addicted to heroin should be able to have some place where they can go and inject freely. And obviously, Sydney has that in King's Cross, I think.
Not sure.
Anyway, I'm not one for the heroin scene.
Pete hasn't been there lately.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah.
The track marks stay. But the point is, there's so much oxygen in the debate of whether or not heroin users should be able to safe inject, but there's not a lot of oxygen in the debate about whether people on terminal illnesses should be able to get access to the drugs that could potentially save their life.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's as if... I blame a lot of people, but I blame red tape, I blame over-regulation, and the paternalistic attitude on behalf of doctors, scientists and government regulators that patients are stupid and that we should not be allowed to take risks, we shouldn't be allowed to have any say in our own destiny. So, you know, you need to protect me from myself.
Mm-hmm. So we have talked about it before, but for first-time listeners, can you please explain what you mean by right to try, and also what's the latest... that you're up to at the moment with that?
Yeah, so I mean, Right to Try is amazing. It's spearheaded in the US. I think there's now something like over 30 states have signed up for it, and Mike Pence is really pushing it in the Trump administration. It's basically a legal waiver that patients will be able to sign and will enable drug companies to give them drugs outside clinical trials on the basis that if they do them harm, that is not going to affect the regulation of these drugs. So all drugs will have passed phase one testing. I'm on a phase one trial of a drug that was developed 30, well, it started being developed 30 years ago, and it's still not available. And the problem is that the average clinical trial process takes 14 years to get from phase one to phase three testing. Phase three trials are where they randomize it against the current best treatment. In terms of my drug, that meant that I would have only been able to get it here if I'd agreed to be randomized against chemotherapy, which I'd already failed. And the people who entered that trial in Australia at the time that I then moved to London to enter my trial, 67% of them who got the chemo arm are no longer here. So it's, to me, it's just almost criminal that we are sacrificing patients on these phase three clinical trials when we know one arm of a trial is better than the other.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this phase one drug you're on was developed in Melbourne, but you had to fly back to London just to get it, even though it was delivered. It was created only a few postcodes over from you.
Yeah, I go to my appointments at the Royal Melbourne and I look out at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, and that's where my drug was developed.
Yeah.
And, you know, more patients in Melbourne were on the original trial than anywhere else in the world. I was just unlucky, or you could say that the system made it difficult for enough clinical trials to open in Australia to meet the need of patients like me, and I wouldn't have been able to get onto a trial here.
So where are you politically with this? What's the latest in terms of getting this?
Well, I'm doing a fair bit of lobbying, but I'm working with Rare Cancers Australia because this is a big issue for people with me who have rarer cancers. There are less options for us. And my drug in particular has been approved by the PBAC, hasn't been funded yet by the PBS, and obviously these are expensive drugs, and that's another issue. But the other thing I'm looking at is what sort of systemic change we need, because even if I have obviously private medical insurance, that doesn't cover the cost of these drugs. So if down the track, you know, one in two of us are going to get cancer, how are we going to afford these $150,000, $200,000 drugs? We can't. And obviously Australia is a small country, can't afford it either. So we need a solution, and it needs to be a systemic change.
Absolutely. So this might be a little bit of a tough transition because that was such a hard topic, but in good news, the IPA is celebrating its 75th anniversary this year, which is a huge milestone, oldest free market think tank in the world, I'm pretty sure.
We are.
Absolutely. Cool. So do you want to tell us about what we got planned for this huge anniversary?
Yeah, well, this is a massive year for us, and we have so much to celebrate. And we're coming off the back of our best year ever in terms of all the members will have seen our annual report. For those people who are listening who aren't members, you can go onto our website. We're so secretive that we publish our annual report on the website, and you'll see that the growth in membership, the growth in income, it's been massive over the past year, and that's thanks to our great boss, John Roscombe, our executive director, and the whole team here at the IPA, and the fact that we are more relevant than ever and we are more needed than ever. So this year we have the 75th Anniversary Society, and that this is really aimed at really securing our funding for the future. So we have, at the moment, 40 of the 75 places have gone, but we have... the aim is to have 75 people making a significant donation to mark 75 years, and those people are in a club where, you know, they're real stakeholders in this organisation. And we also have lots of members' things coming up. Mm-hmm. So that gives me the opportunity to tell you about Robert Toombs.
Yeah, this is the scoop. So Ped and I talked earlier about a scoop.
Our first scoop.
Yeah. Oh, I know. And so we're really excited about this. So Robert Toombs is one of the most preeminent historians in Britain. And he is a fellow from St. John's College in Cambridge. And he was one of the very, very few academics who came out in favour of Brexit. So he's a complete legend and he's completely brave. And he actually founded an academic website called Briefings for Brexit. And he did all this after having written a 1,000-page book called The English in Their History, which I have to say I have started reading, and come back to me in 2 years, I may have finished it, but it's an awesome book.
Time he's got a new edition because of the extra 2 years of history.
But we have him coming over, and we've got him coming for two members' events in Melbourne. He is going to deliver a lecture, Why Western Civilization is Our Future. Isn't that great
very
title?
Good name.
So that will be on
Who
the...
Who came up with that?
I'm sure it's Bella, actually. She's pretty smart. She's got, you know... Was it you, James?
Thank you.
You're smart as well. You just don't have a PhD yet.
And normal
Cambridge.
Yeah. But Pete's on his.
Days away.
How's that writing going?
Oh, it's getting there. It's getting there.
Yeah, well done.
Should start organising my lecture, actually.
So that's 20th of March. And then Sydney, he'll be there on the 22nd of March. These are definitely things to put into the diary. We'll send formal invitations out. You're getting a lovely letter from Bella over the next couple of days. So the team upstairs are busy stuffing envelopes and sending those out. And yeah, hope to see you all there. It'd be fantastic.
Because it was Bella who talked this guy into coming, wasn't it?
She did. She went and had a cup of tea with him. And she's very persuasive.
She can be very persuasive.
Yeah. We never want to run the podcast, but damn it, she just gets us into it. Cool. So obviously, if you guys want to get in touch, get a few more details about that and also about our 75th anniversary, Deb, your email address is available on our website. Just go to Deb's profile. But yeah, so speaking of Brexit, like there's so many headlines. Yeah, transition. Speaking of Brexit, so many headlines these days about like what form Brexit's going to take. And it doesn't really look like Theresa May is, the all-encompassing leader that she should be. So my question is, when is Jacob Rees-Mogg going to be Prime Minister?
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
Wouldn't it be the best.
It's just been, she's been such a disappointment. I was hoping for, the Thatcher-Reagan era, strong, you could just see it. Trump needs someone to be there for him in the UK. And, just everything's so bad. I'm off there in a couple of weeks, and my friends, I caught up with a friend from the BBC yesterday, who, again, was another person who wasn't completely left-wing at the BBC, and she was saying that the last couple of weeks in particular, the faith in Theresa May, if there ever was any, has completely nosedived to the point that everyone's accepting that she's gone. It's only a matter of time, but the problem is there's no obvious successor, as much as, Michael Gove's in the wings and Boris, how good would it be to have Boris as Prime Minister?
Have you met Boris?
Boris ran me over on his push bike outside the Independent Television News headquarters in London at one stage. Yeah.
What did you say?
That could almost have been a Me Too moment.
Yeah.
I mean, he did, grab me as we both fell to the ground.
There you go.
No, not inappropriately.
Oh, okay, right,
In my dreams.
Two scoops.
Love Boris.
Yeah, if he does get Prime Minister, any press conference of like the US and Britain getting together, Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, is appointment television.
Yes.
I would also say for Jacob Rees-Mogg, that is a buddy cop movie waiting to happen.
I'm on the mission to get Lord Rees-Mogg out to Australia.
Yes.
I want all of us to see him, hear him. I think that would be the highlight.
Absolutely.
I'm on it.
He's popular with the young'uns.
Yeah, he is.
He's just the most well-spoken person in the world, with the most delightful accent. I've been on this train for a while. I think I wrote like a Jacob Rees-Mogg should be the next Prime Minister. Hey, what did I miss? In like 2015 or 14. I was early on the train. That's what I'm saying. So remember my words. Deb, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Deb.
Thank you to Gideon and Deborah for those interviews. We'll now get to some stories around the world that made us laugh this week.
Also so, very serious.
Where are the serious ones?
they've all got a deeper point.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, this one's just not. This one doesn't really have a deeper point other than Hillary Clinton's a loser.
We don't abuse on this podcast, James.
Well, she lost an election.
She did. She's technically a loser.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying. Yeah. Sad. So you guys probably didn't watch the Grammys because you make good decisions with your life and your spare time.
James,
but the Grammys,
it?
I did not watch it.
Really?
They could not pay me to watch it.
You love that stuff.
No, the Grammys. The Grammys is like the least important award ceremony in the world. I reckon.
Yeah, but I mean, all of those
name one Grammy winner.
I can't even name an Oscar winner.
Yeah, like a few years ago.
Adele. I love Adele.
Won it a few years ago, I think.
Yeah, but still.
Anyway.
So
we digress.
Now, so one of the skits in the Grammys was people, like celebrities or singers, like auditioning for Best Spoken Word Album, and the spoken word was going to be reading out Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury book. Obviously, you guys would remember it's like this, you know, salacious look behind the scenes of the Trump White House, basically just a whole bunch of stories that this guy had heard from aides or people that had fallen out with Trump.
Yeah.
And he just published them. And so you had like Cardi B, the rapper, reading a few lines. And then you had DJ Khaled reading a few lines.
Hadn't heard of them.
Yeah. Pete was just constantly going, who's that? Why are they like that?
Yeah.
Anyway, the last line reading is someone concealing their full face, reading from it.
Who could it be?
Who could this like rich northeastern accent be? Slowly revealed down and it's Hillary Clinton. And then Corden says, that's the take. And Clinton says, so the Grammy's in the bag. And Michael Corden says, yeah, you're guaranteed to win. Everyone laughs. More realistically, no one laughed.
Oh, Hillary Clinton is so cool and funny.
Yeah. She's so down with the kids. But it's like, so my point is, like, one, like, that's not funny. And why is Hillary Clinton at the Grammys? Why is the Grammys going into politics?
Like, why doesn't she go, I just look like an idiot because I'm like, still patting out this bloke who beat me.
Yeah. This is my point. So, like, Cardi B interrupts her viewing to go, I can't believe this guy's life is like this. And, you know, the whole joke is like, oh, look at all this stuff about Trump. Isn't it crazy that this is our president? And it's like, we all knew this Trump is a crazy guy that ate a lot of cheeseburgers.
Yeah.
And you still lost to him. Like, when you keep bringing it up, it's like, how did you blow this open layup? This was a guarantee.
Yeah.
Any American president would have beaten Trump senseless.
Yeah.
You didn't.
Move on.
Like, stop reminding us about it for the sake of your legacy.
Exactly right.
That is my point.
That's a good point.
And speaking of legacies, it has also come out this week. So Hillary Clinton, big, you know, wore the Me Too badge and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Or Time's Up badge, I think it is.
Yeah, Time's Up.
Now, it has also come out that Hillary Clinton personally, quote, overruled a recommendation that she fire a top campaign staffer accused of sexual harassment in 2008, her campaign manager at the time said on Monday. So Patty Sellers-Doyle used to work for Clinton, then worked for Obama, headed Clinton's presidential bid when a young female staffer accused senior advisor Burns Strider. I mean, that guy sounds like a villain.
Well,
like Burns Strider is a ridiculous name. That's
probably not enough to get him put away.
Probably, no, definitely not. I would say, a young female staffer coming forward saying he abused me and then he gets counseling and doc pay and then comes back and abuses another female should be grounds for him getting fired.
Yeah,
that is my hot take.
Okay, we don't know the details.
Call me a firebrand if you must. But as someone who goes around sexually harassing people, should not be a part of a major campaign.
Well, my thing is, we don't know the details around this case, right? We don't know.
Well, we do know two women came forward and said this guy sexually harassed me. Clinton said, "I'm not firing him."
Okay, fine, but it's like, and I don't like sexual harassment being used as a political football, which it constantly is.
Yes,
but why does this get no coverage? When it's a Republican person, it gets heaps of coverage.
Yeah.
So, and why is she included in this?
Well, because the media love her. And so also, it's like, she's a private citizen now, and it's like, oh, is it as much news? Can you get as much? But you should.
But
because it's crazy.
It doesn't, like the feminist Twitter sphere.
Yeah.
Is in no way.
So Hillary Clinton originally addressed this. A story appeared today. This is her Twitter feed. A story appeared today about something that happened in 2008. I was dismayed when it occurred, but it was heartened that the young woman came forward, was heard, and had her concerns taken seriously and addressed. The way they addressed it, the young woman was moved to another job within the campaign. Good addressing.
Great.
We'll dock that guy's pay. We'll move her around. And then she put out the whole thing. She's now come forward and said, like, yes, I should have fired the guy.
Really?
In a statement released.
So she's admitted she should have fired him.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you don't know that because she released it only a few minutes before Trump's State of the Union address. So just really putting it in when no one's going to be talking about it. No one's even thinking about it. Real brave leadership. Oh, go away, Clinton.
Hypocrisy.
Anyway, that's all I got.
Okay, that's good. I want to go back to straws. For the third or fourth week running.
Third week in a row.
This is the reason.
It started out as a cheap joke.
And it's not.
It started out as a concern of one of our listeners.
One of our many listeners.
One of our many listeners. And it's keeping on going. I think this is, straws are a symbol for everyone. So what's happened is, as we know, in California, that they're trying to introduce a law where waiters will get fined $1,000 if they offer a straw unsolicited or they give a straw unsolicited.
Which we talked about last week. Had a big old laugh.
It was a real thigh slapper.
Yep.
And It's emerged this week, Milo, by Reason in the United States, wonderful organisation in the United States, that the figure that this is based on, it's based on this figure that 500 million straws end up in...
Americans use 500 million straws a year, I think it is.
Yeah.
And then most of it ends up
in trash. Waterways.
Yeah, in waterways.
In waterways. And they raise... And this, like, has been quoted...
environmental damage, we should stop using straws.
Yeah, okay, good summary.
Just context.
Say it again. Context. And so all the environmental organisations are quoting this figure, all the politicians who are in favour of this law are quoting this figure.
Yeah, it's all the in media. Yep.
It has emerged that this $500 million a day figure was reached by a person called Milo Kress. Milo Kress was a 9-year-old when they came up with this figure. And I actually don't know if it's a boy or a girl, but the kid came up with this figure by calling straw manufacturers in 2011.
Yeah, so a 9-year-old kid called straw manufacturers.
And started a campaign saying we should ban straws, which is cute, you know, it's a little kid. And they said there's 500 million straws in our waterways, and this is what the law's based on. Not making this up. Nina's looking at me like I'm making this up.
So there's waiters who will be fined $1,000 because of a 9-year-old's, like, grade 3 project.
Unbelievable. What's your name? Nina.
Hi.
We're all just staff to Pete. It's ridiculous.
You had an opinion on straws before.
Well, yeah, because, like, this is ridiculous. I mean, I've drank stuff with straws, but made of paper. Why can't we just use that?
There you go.
That's biodegradable, and that's hippies. And you can still, I'm telling the truth, and then you can still use the straws.
I don't know, I'm going to need
it's a win-win situation, isn't it?
No,
I'm going to need some cooperation.
We're talking about a plastic straw, right?
Yeah.
Which make a problem.
Yes. Yeah.
We just change to a paper one or a bamboos based one.
You're a problem solver.
What I need Nina to do for this is to do a project with a 9-year-old and come up with some hard data. Hard, impenetrable data. Then I will listen to you.
I'm recruiting 9 years old now.
Okay. Cool. We'll go move on. What do I want to talk about next? I want to talk about this. So emotional support animals is like the biggest rort in America right now. So obviously, like, if you want to take your dog on a cross-country trip, you need to charge extra to have it there, or, you know, you need to sign a million forms.
On a plane.
Basically. But if you say it's your emotional support animal, it's free. They can fly with you in coach.
Explain what an emotional support animal is.
Well, it's basically just like a pet you have that you're like, oh, I really need this by my side at all times, or I get really sad and the planes are too scared to take you on that because of the law, like, you know, the world of social media, and it's like angry retweets and stuff.
Yep.
So they just say, yep, have the dog on or the cat on. You fly it across country for free. It's not by itself in the back, and everyone wins except for everyone else who's like, why is there a dog on this plane?
Yeah.
I like dogs, and dogs on a plane would probably help my trip. But the story that came out this week, United Airlines employees recently stopped a passenger from boarding a flight with her emotional support animal in tow because the animal was a peacock. What emotional support peacock? I need this bird.
You could be supported by a peacock.
Yeah. But, like, that is a logistical nightmare. What if it arcs up and, like, spreads its wings? It's like 20 minutes out.
Yeah. Well, look.
I don't know. Dubious therapeutic value was the reason that United Airlines decided to draw the line.
Peacock, make your case.
It just spreads its wings again.
Argue why you should be able to fly.
Yeah. So the animal did not meet guidelines for a number of reasons, including its weight and size. The United person spokesman said in a statement, we explained this to the customers on 3 separate occasions before they arrived at the airport.
Did they explain it to the peacock?
No, the peacock was not informed. My other point with this is, why would a peacock even want to catch a plane? That is rubbing it in at that point. It's like, hey, look what biology robbed you of thousands of years ago. Look at this. You can't do this. See that bird out the window? It can do this. You can't do this.
It's been waiting all week for that one.
Thank you. Cool. So do you want to talk something else, Pete?
Yeah. Look, in Holland, Rotterdam, police there. So they're having a bit of a crime problem in Rotterdam. What police are doing are confiscating clothes off young men that they believe aren't able to afford them. So if you're walking down the street, the policeman thinks that you're not allowed, you wouldn't be able to afford the jacket you're wearing, they're taking it off them. So I'm going to read out a quote from Rotterdam Police Chief Frank Paul. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. P-A-A-U-W. You've got Dutch heritage, don't you, Bolt?
Allegedly.
So, do you know how to pronounce that?
Nope. Okay. Keep going.
Okay. They are often young guests. Guests. I don't know what's guests, but they're often young guests.
Like tourists, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, Dutch have a lot of tourism.
Airbnb thing.
Yeah.
They are often young guests who consider themselves untouchable. We're going to undress them on the street. This is Frank Poor, Rotterdam police chief.
And not like a character from a movie.
Yeah. We regularly take a Rolex from a suspect, clothes rarely, and that is especially a status symbol for young people. Oh, this guy gets young people. Some young people now walk with jackets of €1,800. They do not have any income. So the question is how they get there.
How do you decide someone doesn't have income by sight? That guy doesn't have income. I wonder what things they'll take into context when they're deciding if someone's too poor to wear a $1,500 jacket.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder.
Skin colour, maybe, probably.
I think if we know that.
Yep. Okay. That is ridiculous. I can't believe that story. Cool. So I will bring up this one. So this is our Q&A clap moment of the week. Usually we leave with this, but we'll save it a bit for the end. Now, as we've been saying on the podcast, DREAM Act is a huge issue in the United States at the moment, talking about whether or not children of illegal immigrants should be able to stay in the country. And people are really putting their toes in the sand, or putting their feet in the sand, saying, I'm not moving on this issue. To add to them is George Lopez, US comedian, talk show host on TBS, I think. And he, look, he was a bit, he'd had a few.
He was hammered.
But here's what he said about the DREAM Act.
The president is an avid golfer, as am I. And I will not golf until there is a clean DREAM Act. I stand with DACA, and the president should as well, because these are educated young people that America needs.
Thank you.
So brave.
That's the bravest stand I've ever heard.
He's
not playing golf.
He's such a
brave
man.
He's not playing an enjoyable pastime until we have a DREAM Act in solidarity.
We need more like him, James.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, that's our Q&A clap moment of the week.
Yep.
That's why we played the clap. Pete and I get jealous when people get applauded for their political views. So we like to give ourselves a Q&A clap for things we might think. So, Pete, what are you foregoing until we get a clean DREAM Act?
Well, I'm not going to go the DREAM Act. What I'm saying is I'm giving up salsa dancing until the federal government pays off Australia's sovereign debt.
Thank you.
Malcolm Turnbull, I'm not going to do any salsa dancing, any, until we're paid off.
Pete, you bust a move, bad.
Oh, mate, the salsa industry's cooked now. James, hit me with
it's
yours.
It's a good time to do it. Spanish music's so popular at the moment. Cool. I am going to talk about DREAM Act. And I want to say, look, George Lopez giving up something very important to himself in golf. I am not going to eat most of a tub of cookies and cream ice cream on Sunday night until Trump passes the DREAM Act in solidarity with the people affected by this legislation.
Thank you.
It's very delicious. And look, this is this kind of thing you have to sacrifice to make brave political points these days.
It's Sunday night cheat night.
Yeah. I like ice cream.
What is that? A window into James's life.
Peek behind the curtain. That's it for the podcast this week.
I've got one more. Sorry,
we didn't
talk about this in
question
the pre-meeting.
Question without notice.
Meeting. Yeah, this is a listener called Murph, another listener called Murph, and I like to call this one for the speaking truth to power files. Sydney Morning
Herald segment. We should bring this back.
Yeah, if we can regularly find something stupid in the papers, we can do this every week. So, the Sydney Morning Herald author Anna Paddy on January 30 wrote an article under the headline, which she wouldn't have written, but the headline: decline in strike action linked to slow wages growth. And she writes, the failure of many Australian workers to get a real pay rise has been linked to a decline in industrial action, including strikes. The analysis by the left-leaning Australian Institute Centre for Future Work think tank, that's not a very good name, shows...
Yeah, work on that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what's the, like, when you take the letters out? What's the...
AICFW.
No.
Yeah, so anyway, they'll think of something. Across Australia, there are 106 industrial disputes in the first 9 months last year, close to a post-war era low, which I didn't know. The new report released on Tuesday found a correlation in the form of a close statistical relationship between a dramatic reduction in industrial activity and stagnation in wages. Then, just apropos nothing, the report does not claim a direct link. Can I remind you of the first line of the article, James? The failure of many Australian workers to get a real pay rise has been linked to a decline in industrial action. Anna Paddy, you're speaking truth to power. Thanks, Murph, for that.
Wait, so it's like the report says it's not a clear link and the article's like, don't worry.
Headline.
We got a link.
Headline, decline in strike action linked to slow wages growth. First sentence,
The lamestream media at it again.
Oh, lamestream media. Yeah. All so right. I think speaking truth to power could be something to work with.
Yeah, we'll think about that. Yeah. Cool. So that is it for the show this week. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. Available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and our website. Make sure you're telling your friends about it. Spread the word. Bring some more people into the fold. And if you are listening on iTunes, do us a favor. Just head on over and give us a 5-star review. Helps us with the rankings.
Yep.
And yeah, if you want to become part of the IPA, obviously we've been talking about a whole lot of issues today. Australia's high freedom. We could get even higher rating on a freedom index.
Get to 4th.
Yep. Talking about all the pressure we're putting on the Champions government League. To redraft this donations law, redraft a few other things. Nina, where could people go if they want to become part of the Institute of Public Affairs?
You can just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and just click on that join button. And for $22 for a year, you'll receive 4 editions of IPA reviews and also weekly emails from James Pitt and Morgan Back on Hey, What Did I Miss?
Absolutely.
On your needs.
Cool. See you guys next week.
Stay up.